Palestine Chronicle wrote, on the first day of the Muslim Eid al-Fitr on April 11th, the Zionist regime army announced the beginning of a military operation in the central Gaza Strip, particularly in the Nusayrat refugee camp. Scores of people were murdered and hundreds injured, including children, in the continued Israeli regime airstrikes and artillery shelling. Just as it has happened in other areas of Gaza, the Zionist regime forces targeted civilian infrastructure, homes, schools, and even mosques. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with four residents of the camp who shared their testimonies on the horrific Israeli regime invasion. Ali Al-Jodeili told the Palestine Chronicle, on the very first day of their incursion, Israeli occupation forces bombed two schools operated by UNRWA, two mosques, and dozens of homes. The two mosques destroyed were the Mu'adh ibn Jabal Mosque, located on the northern entrance of Nusayrat, and Zulnairan Mosque, located in the northwestern area of the camp. But they did not stop there. On the fourth day of its ongoing operation, the Israeli army also destroyed the Hassan al-Banna Mosque, the oldest mosque in the new area of the Nusayrat refugee camp. Ahmad al-Ghoreinawi is a resident of Nusayrat. He was particularly attached to the mosque. Al-Ghoreinawi told Palestine Chronicle, the occupation destroyed Hassan al-Banna Mosque, which houses the Muhammad School for Quran Memorization, attended by over 400 children. He explained, the Banna Mosque also included a football field with artificial turf, inaugurated about 2 years ago, and a large scientific library always filled with students. The occupation has deprived children and students of one of the most important places for education and recreation in Nusayrat. During the 6 months of genocidal war on Gaza, the child-killing regime of Israel has also systematically targeted schools. According to the latest figures provided by the Palestinian Ministry of Education, at least 378 schools were destroyed and damaged in Gaza. Additionally, at least 4,327 students, at least 231 teachers and 94 professors were murdered. Fatemeh Mohammed told the Palestine Chronicle that she was shocked when she learned that Israel had completely destroyed her children's school. She said, my children, Mohammed and Ahmad, used to study at Malaysian Quranic School, located north of the Nusayrat camp, but Israel bombed it and destroyed it, depriving my children of their place of learning. My children loved their school very much, and they were traumatized when they found out what had happened. She said, I hesitated before breaking the news to them, but I also wanted my children to understand the crimes of the occupation and to be aware of the war it is waging against everything and everyone in Gaza. Muhammad Abu Al-Raus works as a teacher at the Malaysian Quranic School. He told the Palestine Chronicle the school was located on the outskirts of the Nusayrat camp and there were no buildings around it, so there is no justification for the bombing. The truth is, the occupation aims to destroy all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip to punish its residents for their refusal to migrate. Al-Raus added, saying, also, by bombing schools, the occupation tries to deprive future generations of their right to education, but it will not succeed. We will teach our children in tents, under the sun, and anywhere else. We are determined to raise an educated and informed Palestinian generation capable of resisting the occupation and exposing its crimes in all international forums. According to Wafa news agency, Palestinian media reported attacks on two mosques, a UN-run school and a Malaysian school in the Nusayrat refugee camp recently. Also in central Gaza, several residential homes and a market were subjected to Israeli regime strikes. Elsewhere in northern Gaza, the Faras market was targeted. Strikes were also reported in the southern city of Rafah, according to Palestinian media. Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 68 people were murdered and 94 others were injured in seven massacres in the past 24 hours. It has put the death toll of the Israeli regime aggression on the Gaza Strip at least 34,000 people. The ministry added that the number of injured people reached at least 76,094. Meanwhile, Civil Defense in Gaza said on its Telegram channel that it recovered 13 more decomposing bodies in Khan Yunis, Al-Balad and Al-Amal neighborhoods. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described the destruction in the southern city of Khan Yunis as profound. In a post on X, the UN Office said a team has visited Khan Yunis and witnessed destroyed homes, schools and hospitals, as well as unexploded ordnance.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, free yourself from those chains in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So yes, we have a long title on the program today on A to Z, and that is free yourselves from the chains that are shackling you down as a part of our Islamic lifestyle and living our Islamic lifestyle. So what in the world are we talking about? Well, let's kind of break it up into separate pieces so that it's easier to understand for you and for me. So we're talking about living a Islamic lifestyle, first and foremost. So as a part of living a Islamic lifestyle, you know, we should not live a un-Islamic lifestyle. Make sense? Or are we more confused now than we were before? Well, perhaps we're a little bit more confused. Now, when we're talking about not living, that means we do not want to live a life which is un-Islamic, right? And so that is one side of the coin. That means that we start to get rid of things which are un-Islamic. And on the other hand, we are trying to achieve that ultimate Islamic lifestyle. So that means that we need to inculcate and work on implementing things into our life which are Islamic. So these are the first two coins as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Now, the other thing which is a part of this incredibly long title that we're talking about is to free ourselves from the chains that are shackling down, and that is something that we're going to talk about in the next segment. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how this Islamic lifestyle has two sides to it. The one side is to implement and inculcate Islamic things into our lifestyle. And the other side of that coin was to get rid of un-Islamic things that are unfortunately have become a part of our lifestyle. But now the last thing that we want to talk about, which is part of our title, is to, you know, free ourselves from these shackles that are chaining us down. You know, sometimes we have the wrong perspective on what is a burden, right? A burden is something that it weighs you down. It's a shackle. It keeps you chained. We have the wrong aspect on what is thing is a burden and what thing is not a burden. And it comes back to what we consider to be Islamic and what we consider to be not Islamic. And, you know, and within Islamic, what do we consider to be important and valuable and what we don't? So, for example, you know, we think that prayers, salah, the five daily prayers, is a burden, when in reality that is something that frees us from the shackles. So what are shackles? Greed, jealousy, lust, carnal desires, I don't know, you know, and a lot of them kind of revolve around all of these things, right? Pride and arrogance, and these are the things which chain us down, and these are the things that we need to free ourselves from. And I guarantee you that when you overcome something like greed, or you overcome something like arrogance, or you overcome other kind of, you know, Islamically delineated moral and ethical vices, when you overcome them, you will feel a sense of true divine power as well as freedom from these things that shackle us down. And so an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle is to free ourselves from these shackles that are chaining us down.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Limelight. In New York, United States, the first seven jurors have been seated in Donald Trump's trial as the judge warns the former president about his comments. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Seven Manhattan residents were selected to serve on the jury in former President Donald Trump's criminal trial on Tuesday, 16th of April, as lawyers for both sides clashed over which potential jurors should be seated and the judge warned the defendant to remain quiet. During the selection process, the anonymous members of the jury were known only by their letters and numbers. There are four men and three women, ranging from young to middle-aged. They include a salesman, a nurse, two lawyers, and an IT consultant, a teacher, and a software engineer. They all answered questions about their background and their opinion of Donald Trump before they were chosen to serve on the jury as one of the highest-profile trials in American history. One member of the jury, a nurse, said she doesn't really have an opinion of the former president. She promised that she is here for my civic duty and to listen to the facts. The IT consultant said, "My family is my hobby," and admitted to finding Trump fascinating and mysterious. The teacher said she had friends with strong opinions of Donald Trump, but added that she's not very interested in politics or the news. "President Trump speaks his mind, and I'd rather than that someone who's in office, who you don't know what they're thinking," she said. She was not aware that Donald Trump faces criminal charges in other cases. The jurors were advised by Judge Juan Merchan to plan on returning for opening statements on Monday, 22nd of April. Judge Juan Merchan said the court would let them know if that plan changes. At least five more jurors plus another half a dozen alternates must still be chosen. Roughly 80 people have been excused since questioning began on Monday. Most of them said they could not be impartial in deciding a case involving Donald Trump. Others were dismissed based on their answers to questions about their political beliefs or social media posts. Six of the jurors were selected and sworn in together earlier in the afternoon. A seventh juror was added after further questioning of another batch of potential members. The jury selection process will resume on Thursday, 18th of April. A dispute over one potential juror's Facebook post showing celebrations after Trump lost the 2020 election prompted audible comments from the former president on Tuesday. That earned him an admonishment from Judge Juan Merchant, who told Donald Trump's attorney Todd Blanche to speak to his client. "Mr. Blanche, your client was audibly uttering something. He was audible, gesturing and speaking in the direction of the juror. I won't tolerate that," the judge said. "I will not have any jurors intimidated in my courtroom. I want to make that crystal clear." Todd Blanche had asked the judge to dismiss the juror over the video post which showed people cheering in the streets of New York. The woman told the court that she wanted to capture a New York City celebratory moment, likening the cheers to nightly celebrations for healthcare workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. She insisted that she could remain impartial during the trial. The judge initially said she provided reasonable explanations for both posts, but she was ultimately dismissed. He also excused another man who had posted about Donald Trump's unlawful travel ban and wrote, "Get him out and lock him up." Those disputes came after prosecutors and defense attorneys got their first chance to directly question potential jurors who made it past the first round of screening. Earlier, Joshua Steinglass, a member of the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office, told the jurors that the case has nothing to do with your politics. "We don't suggest you need to have been living under a rock for the last 8 years or the last 30 years," he said. "You don't expect you not to have heard about this or not to have discussed this case with your friends. What we do need from you is to keep an open mind." Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president, is charged with 34 state felony counts of falsification of business records related to a hush money payment that his attorney made to a film actress Stormy Daniels before the 2016 presidential election. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges, claiming the prosecution is part of a plot by Democrats aimed at preventing him from retaking the White House. The case is the first of four criminal prosecutions against Donald Trump to make it to trial. Entering the courtroom on Tuesday, 16th of April, Donald Trump called the trial a sham and said the charges should have been dismissed. "This is a trial that should never happen. It should have been thrown out a long time ago," he told reporters. At several points during Monday morning's arguments, Donald Trump appeared to fall asleep at the defense table, his chin dropping to his chest briefly. In one instance, he was stirred awake by his attorney. He appeared to doze off at several points again on Tuesday. The trial is expected to last between 6 and 8 weeks, convening every weekday except Wednesdays. Donald Trump is required to attend the trial. The schedule severely limits Trump's ability to hit the campaign trail, which he has cited to support his claims of political bias. Donald Trump said on Tuesday, "I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states like North Carolina and Georgia. I should be campaigning." CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. Seven jurors have been selected in the second day of Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial, which concluded on Tuesday with the selection of seven jurors. A panel of 12 New Yorkers and likely six alternates will ultimately be chosen. The trial will resume on Thursday, 18th of April. The judge, Juan Merchan, has reprimanded the former president, Donald Trump. Judge Juan Merchan on Tuesday gave the former president a stern warning for visibly and audibly reaching to one of the potential jurors. "I will not have any jurors intimidated in my courtroom," he said. Donald Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records for his alleged role in a hush money scheme before the 2016 presidential election. Trump has pleaded not guilty. Trump is the first former president in U.S. history to go to criminal trial. His legal challenges come as he juggles the campaign and courtroom as the 2024 presumptive GOP nominee. Donald Trump is expected, after court, to stop at a Manhattan bodega where an employee stabbed a man in a 2022 incident that sparked backlash against Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Alvin Bragg is currently leading the hush money case against the former president. Jose Alba was a worker at what is now called the Sanar convenience store in Upper Manhattan in July of 2022, when he was charged with second-degree murder after stabbing a man who came behind the counter and shoved him. Jose Alba and his lawyers argued that he acted in self-defense, and the charges were later dismissed amid a backlash to Alvin Bragg's decision to charge him. Donald Trump is expected to talk about crime and inflation, according to the pool covering the former president's visit.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad
Prophet.
Muhammad
Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of
Youth Station.
I am Beta.
And this is Mustafa. So the topic that I want to discuss today is very much related to, I think, why I'm here, right? Why I'm sitting here right now speaking to you. And that is that, you know, in 1979, we all know that Iran had a revolution. And the government at that time was sort of thrown out. And we had Imam Khomeini come and bring an Islamic revolution here in Iran. And I do want to emphasize that it's an Islamic revolution, not an Iranian revolution.
Exactly.
Right? Because a lot of people, especially outside of Iran, do confuse the two things together. Yeah. Right? They think, oh, this is a revolution in Iran. What does that have to do with Islam? No, it was an Islamic revolution.
It was an Islamic
revolution. And it's had... you know, it's had a huge impact on the world. It's probably changed, in my view, it's like changed history. You know, it's changed the direction that countries and people were going in.
The thing is, brother, at the time of the revolution, I wasn't even born here. Yeah. And at all of the things that I know is throughout the history books and what I've learned to hear in the books and in the newspapers and all of the things that remained after that time of revolution, which I believe the effect of the revolution still is alive among the Muslim nations that... the power and the courage that was promoted at that time in order to actually fight for your own right, fight for the Islam's right, you know. And this is the beauty of the Islamic revolution, I call it. It wasn't only a revolution of one nation. It was the revolution that helped the whole community of Muslim countries in order to
wake up.
Exactly. Right. It was a reminder.
Yeah, not only, I mean, there's so many effects of it that, you know, I could talk a lot about this, by the way. You know, one of the effects that I think it had, it increased our knowledge about our religion. For example, my mom says that up until the revolution, like, you know, she had never even heard of what Dua-e Komail is, right? Which is a very popular...
It is nowadays.
She didn't know what that was. It was only after the revolution when we had scholars coming here, learning and going back to our countries. You know, many people didn't even do hijab, for example. They didn't observe many of the religious sort of rules and regulations because they didn't even know what they were. Right, in our maybe in Iran they knew, but at least I know back in Pakistan, many people didn't know that. So just one of the huge effects is just the increase in knowledge and and in people's learning about Islam itself.
And another thing that I want to add here is that it was a reminder for us to remember that Islam is a religion of society. It's not only a kind of thing that you as an individual can choose. It's a lifestyle for you to live in the society. And there are so many actually principles in Islam that are social, like Hajj, like, for example, the prayers of Jum'ah that we have that is actually a sign of unity of the Muslim Ummah, which is really important. And this revolution was a reminder for people to awaken them from this sleep that, okay, I have my own religion, you have your own religion, we have nothing to do with each other. And this, as you know, the murmur of individualism that is, that was in the ears of people.
Another part of it is, by the way, I think the revolution sort of broke the paradigm that the people are living in the sense it gave people hope. Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people the view that they had about the world is that, you know, we have these superpowers. At that time it was Russia and, you know, America, and they're really controlling the world.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of Muslims, even till this day, I would say, think that, you know, they're controlling the world. We can't do anything about it. Only once the 12th Imam returns is when, you know, things will change. The revolution showed, no, you can make brain change, you know. You can go against sort of like the superpowers, right? There is hope, and you shouldn't just be sitting around doing nothing. If you do something, you can change the way things are. You don't have to accept the oppression of the world and the leaders upon you. You can do something about it. So that's a huge impact that it's had.
Hope was a really important hint to mention. Another thing is about the courage of these people, that it doesn't matter whether the world is against you. When you have the hand of God on your shoulder, when you have the right belief in order to be defended, then you can go there, you can fight, and God will help you, inshallah, in this world for sure. And you will be the winner. It doesn't matter whether you win or not at the end of the day, because defending the rights of the truth of this world, you will be the winner. Like what happened in in the era of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him and his family, that Hazrat Zainab salamullah alayha told that I saw nothing but beauty.
Right.
So in the shed of blood and all of those losing the beloved ones, she saw nothing but beauty. And this is the exact thing that we were talking about. You have to have the courage in order to defend what you think is true. So, brother, I believe
we have to go for a break.
Yeah,
and then we'll come back.
Thank you.
So coming back from the break, and, you know, you made a very beautiful point. You know, you brought the example of Karbala, Imam Hussein, and Hazrat Zainab. And, you know, the impact that that had on society back then up until now, I would say, in my view, the revolution in Iran has had a similar impact in the sense that it's really, you know, made people alive and awake. You know, it's made them realize that of what is real Islam is, by the way. What one of the words that Imam Khomeini used was Islam-e-Nab or Islam-e-Muhammadi, which is, you know, which is pure Islam. Before this, I think we didn't know what pure Islam is. And one part of pure Islam is, you know, being a revolutionary. Yeah. I think, like, for example, Prophet Muhammad, he, peace be upon him, he brought a revolution in you know, Medina and Mecca.
Exactly.
In the same way, the Iranian revolution, I think, has brought a revolution in Islamic thinking, in the way we think about government, in the way we think about politics. So it's really changed how we think about our religion. That it's not just something that you do individually in your home, you know, that you're just sitting there praying with a prayer bead, because that's what I know people who still think that, by the way.
Yeah.
For them, you know, religion is just like sitting at home, praying, being a good human being. Whatever's going on in society, it's not your business.
Yeah.
Okay? So I think that's one of the effects of the revolution, is letting people know it's a societal, it's a political, it's a complete package, right?
It is. And I believe this revolution was an alarm for people to put out this kind of cover of selfishness, you know, that you are selfish, you want everything for yourself. And we have in Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi's speech that you have to be selfless in order to make this society works. And another thing that he mentioned was that it wasn't only an external revolution, like a political one. It was the revolution of a spiritual soul of our society. And this is one of the most important and most beautiful aspects of our revolution, that it was a revolution of your heart. And suddenly you came to yourself and you asked yourself, what am I doing with my life? Death is there for me. And we have this beautiful hadith and narration from Imam Ali, peace be upon him, that to live like this is the last day of your life.
Right.
Okay? And this is exactly the same thing. You need to trigger yourself with all these truth and facts in order to live your life in a way you're proud of, in a way that you have Allah's approval.
Right. That's a very good point, that the revolution has had a very spiritual effect as well. You know, it's made us familiar with what Islamic spirituality is. So it's, you know, it wasn't just like, you know, like you're saying, a political revolution. It's really changed how we think about our soul, our spirits. I mean, a big part of it is, of course, martyrdom.
Yeah.
You know, there is now a, I would almost say, the importance of martyrdom has also become, it's become like a part of our culture, right?
Exactly.
This was not necessarily a huge part of our culture, but now we're seeing that even the idea of martyrdom, of, you know, giving our kids our blood for this religion, it's spread far and wide, you know, among among Muslims. And it's not just an impact on, I would say, just Shia Muslims. It's had an impact on non-Muslims, on Sunnis, on everyone. We have to go for a quick break. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So we're back, and we've been discussing, you know, the impact of the Islamic revolution that came in Iran in 1979. Now, how many, it's been, what, 44 years now?
Yeah, for,
We'll be 45 this coming year, right? So one of the things that, by the way, Ayatollah Khamenei said in one of his speeches, he said that, you know, we're going to be seeing the effects of the revolution. Maybe we'll really understand it after 100 years from now. It's still too early to realize, like, the impact that it's had.
Exactly.
It's, you know, I would say it's an earthquake. It caused an earthquake in the world, right? And the tremors, they're still going on, you know?
Yeah.
They haven't stopped in the world.
Beautiful example. By the way, there is another point that I have to mention here, which is actually, as you know, this is Youth Station.
Right.
And the most important goal of that revolution was to educate the youth generation in order to be there for the people who are oppressed. And I think this is the most important lesson I've learned from this revolution, me personally, that I have to stand there. I have to have my voice for the people who are oppressed and, you know, cannot and do not have the voice to defend themselves. And this youth generation is the treasure, is the source for the survival of a revolution, I believe.
Definitely. I mean, I think it was the youth that brought about the revolution, right, in 1979. And that shows you how important the youth is, right, in any society. So, yes, your point about, you know, oppression is very valid, because we see that, for example, one of the things that happened after the revolution, one of the things that Imam Khomeini brought in was Yom Quds, was the Day of Quds, right? Yeah. He made... One of the things, you know, that he made really important was the issue of Palestine. Why did he make it important? Because they were being oppressed.
Exactly.
Right? It wasn't like something that was being done in Iran, right? It was something that's happening in another country, right? Something.
Definitely.
But because we are standing with the people that are oppressed, you know, that has become so important today, to the point that we're seeing the events that are happening right now in Palestine and Gaza. I would say those... It's a result of the 1979 revolution. It couldn't have happened without it, right? The people are resisting there right now, or in Lebanon, in other, or in Yemen, or in other places.
Exactly. And I believe there is a lot to say about the revolution and its consequences, and not only in my own country, but also on all the peoples from the Muslim Ummah, and not only Muslim people. I believe it had its own, actually, consequences on the people around the world, right, in order to be alert, and in order to actually be awakened from the deep sleep of not knowing and not wanting to know anything.
Okay, so I didn't realize we're done, we're out of time, because I said we could continue with this topic for a while.
Exactly.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this, but I would definitely say go and research the Islamic Revolution if you feel you need to. There's so much to learn there. So thank you so much for listening. Wa alaykum assalam.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings, be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif, 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 Ya Latif,
Allah, Allah, Allah. In the limelight.
The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee have pledged to deploy 100,000 attorneys and volunteers to monitor the upcoming presidential vote next November. Democrats and election experts say that figure is unrealistic and have expressed concern the effort could hamper normal election operations and intimidate American voters. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican National Committee and former President Donald Trump's campaign announced a new initiative on Friday, 19th of April, to deploy thousands of monitor vote counting in battleground states during the presidential election. The Republican Party aims to recruit 100,000 volunteers to observe the voting process and report irregularities, as well as lawyers to provide rapid response services if there are issues in vote counting. The Republican National Committee is hiring hundreds of election integrity staff across the map more than ever before, because our party will be recruiting thousands of more observers to protect the vote in 2024, according to Lara Trump, Republican National Committee co-chair, in a press release. Lara Trump added, "These campaign officials in states are tasked with recruiting, training, and when possible, shifting poll watchers and poll workers day in and day out." The operation plans to set up an election integrity hotline in every battleground state and create a command center for lawyers to respond to reports from volunteers. There will also be monthly training sessions on monitoring voting sites and ballot counting centers, according to the press release. The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee are calling it the most extensive and monumental election integrity program in the nation's history. Every jurisdiction in the country allows people to observe but not interfere with the voting and counting process, according to David Becker. CBS News election law contributor and a founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David Becker doubts that Republicans will be able to attract as many volunteers for the effort as they have claimed. "Transparency in elections is a good thing," David Becker said, "but I don't recall a single presidential election in recent memory where there weren't promises of recruiting an army of thousands of poll watchers, and those have never materialized." The program was designed by the Trump campaign, along with newly installed Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Whatley, Lara Trump, and Republican National Committee Chief Counsel Charlie Spies. Before Trump selected him to the chair of the Republican National Committee, Michael Whatley worked on election integrity initiatives as the chair of the North Carolina Republican Party. His history with these efforts was a motivating factor for Donald Trump when he selected him to succeed Ronald McDaniel as party chair. The announcement underscores an effort by former President Trump to refocus the Republican National Committee on election integrity, which Trump felt previous party leaders failed to accomplish during the 2020 presidential election. Despite Donald Trump's focus on the issue, there was no evidence of widespread fraud during the 2020 presidential election. Trump is currently facing federal and state charges relating to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The Democratic National Committee, the DNC, accused the Trump political operation of trying to undermine the results of the 2024 presidential election. Donald Trump knows he's running a losing campaign, so he's working with his hand-picked team of election deniers at the Republican National Committee to once again lay the groundwork to undermine our democracy and spread baseless lies about a rigged election. According to Alex Floyd, the Democratic National Committee Rapid Response Director. The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. Donald Trump's presidential campaign and the Republican National Committee, the RNC, announced a massive election integrity operation on Friday, 19th of April, promising to deploy 100,000 volunteers and attorneys to battleground states to protect the vote and ensure a big win next November. In a press release, officials said they wanted the volunteers and lawyers to monitor logic and accuracy testing, early voting, ballot tabulation, mail ballot processing, and election day voting, as well as post-election canvassers, audits, and recounts. The release suggests they may intend to recruit poll workers as well. Having the right people to count the ballots is just as important as turning out voters on election day, Donald Trump said in his press release. The Republican National Committee is hiring hundreds of election integrity staff across the map, more than ever before, because our party will be recruiting thousands of more observers to protect the upcoming vote in 2024. These campaign officials in states are tasked with recruiting, training, and when possible, shifting poll watchers and poll workers day in and day out, according to RNC's co-chair, Lara Trump. Poll watching is a normal part of the elections. Both parties do it, but experts warn that unruly operations can be a problem. And as Donald Trump and his allies continue to make false claims about the 2020 election, some experts worry that the empowering these sort of observers at polling sites could hamper normal election operations or even intimidate American voters. The GOP released notes they plan to work with passionate grassroots coalitions who are deeply invested in fighting voter fraud. The planned operation would double the Republican National Committee's promised 50,000-person operation from 2020 presidential election, though some experts said both figures were aspirational and unrealistic. The Republican National Committee did not respond to a request for data on how many people had volunteered or been staffed in recent elections. English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Our friends in the negotiating team are aware of our viewpoints. We have discussed the details, those that I'm concerned about, with them. Of course, there are many details that I do not get involved in. We are after reaching an agreement. If someone says that there is a person among the officials of the Islamic Republic who is not after reaching an agreement, they have said a wrong thing. Everyone should know this. All the officials of the Islamic Republic, me, the administration, the Majlis, the judiciary branch, different security and military organizations and the like share the view that an agreement should be reached. Everyone also shares the view that this agreement should be an honorable one and that the interests of the Islamic Republic should be considered in a careful and scrupulous way. There is no disagreement about this. I, the administration, the Majlis, and every other organization and person share these beliefs and opinions. Thank you.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The agreement should be a fair agreement, one that ensures the interests of the Islamic Republic. I should add that we are after the lifting of sanctions. Our purpose of entering into the nuclear negotiations is to lift sanctions. We are seriously pursuing the goal of lifting sanctions, but at the same time, we consider sanctions as an opportunity. It should not be the case that some people express surprise at the idea of sanctions as an opportunity. They might say, "How can sanctions, such a bad thing, be an opportunity? Sanctions made us rely on ourselves. They made us think about our inner capabilities and the pursuit of domestic capacities. That we import everything with oil earnings is the most dreadful disaster and the problem for a country like ours. Unfortunately, this problem has been haunting our country since the pre-revolutionary era, and it is continuing in a very serious way. We should put an end to this. We pursued domestic capacities in the area of science, technology, and different other areas. By Allah's favor, we should do the same in the area of the economy." These were our statements about the nuclear issue.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, more than 70% of the fatalities of the brutal Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip are children and women. Likewise, according to reports issued by the Euro-Mediterranean Center for Human Rights, women and children in Gaza are enduring displacement, death, pain, and suffering in a way that the human mind cannot bear. More than 80% are living in tents without the minimum basic needs to live, without water, without food, with a chilling cold. The current situation is pushing them to the limit, making it impossible to focus on anything but survival.
Today, innocent civilians are placed in inhumane conditions which do not possess the most basic requirements for human survival. When it comes to children and women, the suffering becomes more painful because women's needs are greater. Women today live in tents. There is no bathroom. There is no toilet. They cannot take care of themselves. They have to stand in long lines in front of men's bathrooms, and this means double suffering. Also, do not forget pregnant women or those who gave birth during the attack. We're talking about an aggression that affects all vital aspects.
Pregnant women and those who have given birth in the midst of war are one of the most affected groups. Similarly, the United Nations Population Fund estimated that since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, approximately 60,000 women are pregnant, and of them, 5,500 would give birth soon, many of them by cesarean section. This means that terrible hospital sanitary conditions, as well as the food crisis, will endanger their lives and the lives of newborn babies.
Pregnant women are suffering from extreme cold, food shortages, and medicine shortages. We have noticed an increase in the rate of spontaneous abortions, an increase in the rate of premature births, and an increase in cases of small fetuses. Pregnant women leave the hospital about 10 hours after giving birth and go to the tents, where they have no means of living. Newborn babies are exposed to many diseases. We have observed that a large percentage of these women return to the hospital with their children who have caught a cold, and some have also died.
The lack of hygiene and high levels of malnutrition experienced in overcrowded refugee camps are a poisonous mixture. According to the World Food Program, there's a high risk of famine, and cases of dehydration and malnutrition are increasing rapidly. Many mothers say they only eat once a day to survive. However, there are children who have stopped talking or eating because of what they have seen and experienced. Others cry and scream with every loud sound they hear. Months of war have traumatized an entire generation of children.
You see the atmosphere. Making bread is suffering. To go to the bathroom, you have to wait in line. To get water and foods, you also have to wait in line. That is, our entire life is suffering. In the tent where I live, there are approximately 8 people and my daughter, her husband, and her daughter as well. That is 13 people in just 9 square meters. We have to make the bread here, you see, and if we don't find cardboard to light the fire, we can't bake the bread. We only have 1 bottle of water a day and food. If they give us help, we eat. And if they don't give us food, no, because the price of goods is multiplied by 10. The suffering we experience as children is that we have been forced out of our homes. Our houses were bombed when we were inside it. My friend, who was my cousin, has died. All my friends have died, and I have no one left. Our childhood has been stolen from us. I want to go back to my house. I want the war to end and return home so I can rest.
Gazans continue to call for Israel to fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law, which begins with the protection of civilian lives. They assure that all they want is the end of this nightmare full of death and pain. Palestinian women have always been the symbol of the strong law of resistance. However, displacement, hunger, and lack of health care due to the Zionist war are disproportionately affecting women. They claim that even their dignity has been lost. And for that reason, they will never forget, and they will take revenge for these violations and the misery they are in just because of the Zionist regime. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
Chanting anti-Israel slogans and carrying placards with messages thanking the IRGC for conducting Operation True Promise. Thousands of Iranians marched down the streets in major cities across the country after the Friday prayers to voice their support for the armed forces and a recent punitive military operation carried out against Israel, dubbed Operation True Promise. The retaliatory attack was in response to Israel's deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria on April the 1st, resulting in the martyrdom of top IRGC commander, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, and 6 other military officers. The punitive retaliatory attack involved a slew of drones and missiles targeting and causing damage to Israeli military bases.
There was a time